Thank you very much, Kim Gordon. Steve Bertrand here. It is the Wintrust Business Lunch, a Thursday afternoon, a summery Thursday afternoon as we get close to Memorial Day and the long holiday weekend. Thanks very much for joining us. We're going to talk pot a little bit later in the program. There's a bill, I think, in Springfield. I don't know that it has much of a chance, but that would legalize recreational marijuana in Illinois. You know, they're fighting for dollars in Illinois. So a group of economists looked at the numbers. They looked at the four states where you can buy marijuana now and tried to extrapolate the numbers about what that would mean for tax revenue in Illinois. So we will add up the numbers and have a bag of potato chips a little bit later in the half hour. Elise Glink will be here, too, to talk marketing. But right now it's Dennis Rodkin from Crane Chicago Business who comes by from time to time on Thursday afternoons. Dennis, thanks for braving the conditions out there.
Hi, Steve. Yeah, it's so hard to walk down the street when it's so beautiful out.
It is beautiful outside today. So let's talk home sales because that's you cover real estate, and we tend to cover the market, you know, in the fact that Illinois' rebound in the housing industry has been slower than much of the country. But the numbers are really good in April. So does that mean we're back?
It doesn't mean we're back. It means we may be headed back. Yeah. April had the highest home sales in the Chicago area of any April in at least 8 years. And the records aren't easy to find prior to 8 years, but this April was probably better than those as well. So going back at least 8 years, more home sales in April than ever before. And one of the reasons that's especially good is that they were really weak the couple of months before. The March figures, which I was here to talk about, were quite disappointing. Sales were actually down in the city and almost down, up like 0.2% in the suburbs. So to finally see them come rushing back, it's just sort of this delayed spring effect. But no, are we back? No, we're just doing a little better.
So in the city, up 7.9% from the April before, and in the nine-county area, up 9.3%. I mean, that's a big jump.
Yeah, it was. Yeah, going back 8 years, it's big, but just over what happened a year before, because, of course, 2015 was pretty healthy. So a year later, we're even better. So, you know, we're taking steps up. Next week will be the data that tells us exactly where we are. There's a release on Tuesday that will say where we are vis-a-vis other cities, and then I'll be able to tell you that.
Is that the 20 markets?
That's the one.
Case-Shiller. Yeah. Okay.
And so then we'll know where we stand.
So what do we look for there?
Whether we do better than Washington, D.C., because for most of the past, I can't remember, I think 15 months, we and Washington have been battling out to be number 20 out of 20.
Okay.
So will we pull up and, you know, maybe we'll pull up to 18, 17? It doesn't look that likely because while we did well in April and other figures have been good, other cities have just been booming ahead of us.
All right. So one area where we're booming in Chicago is in not sales of existing homes, right? That's still pretty tight, the inventory.
Right.
But in the building of new homes.
Yeah.
Which is exploding.
Is exploding, yeah. Up more than 30% year to date at the end of April for home sales, new construction home sales. That's houses, townhouses, condos. It's still a small percentage of everything that's sold, but you used the word inventory. One of the reasons new home sales are up in the city is that they fill this inventory gap. We've had such tight inventory of homes for sale all this year and even in prior years. Builders see that gap and they can fill it because they don't, you know, many of them bought the land during the recession.
Well, that's what I was going to say, right? So the inventory is low because a lot of people who might sell are still underwater.
Are still underwater, right. My existing home is not going to make me any money if I sell it, so I sit in it. But you, a builder, bought a lot, a foreclosure.
You bought my underwater home.
Yeah, years ago
cheaply,
and sat on it.
And now you're benefiting from, right?
I'm not pointing fingers.
I'm not pointing fingers.
I don't think they did it in a malicious way. But, yeah, they bought things that were very low priced. They bought things that were tear-down candidates. They may have been abandoned homes. They may have been foreclosures. And so they can put something on the market. I mean, not immediately because obviously they have to build it. But they can put it on the market faster than I, a homeowner who am underwater, can do it because I've got to wait for it to get up to the point where I can afford to sell and move forward.
There's audio now. There's always going to be audio of Donald Trump saying something, but there's audio of him saying that this is back in the day, right? You heard it, that he hopes there's a housing crash because guys like him can then make a lot of money.
Yeah, and there are people all over the city, developers who had that kind of foresight, who were buying land or let's say, lower quality houses during the recession, may have sat on them as rentals for the past couple of years, and then when they saw this spot in the market, said, okay, I'm done with the rentals, I'm rehabbing, I'm tearing down and rebuilding, whatever it is.
So new homes are hot in the city,
yeah,
but not in the suburbs.
Not in the suburbs, yes. Sales are down, are barely eking along, inching along in the suburbs, but they're booming in the
city. Why is it, why in the suburbs? Is that because they've already torn down every house under $500,000?
Yes, that's exactly right. No, one of the reasons is we've got bigger job growth in the city than in most of the suburban job corridors.
So that's good news for Rahm Emanuel, isn't it? I mean, he talks about rejuvenating the job market, and maybe he's doing it.
Yeah, and you just pointed out my other job, which is as an Emanuel campaigner.
Yeah, nice job. I appreciate the. You know what? I'm not going to wear the button, but I thanks for bringing it in.
I'll leave it here on your table.
That's Dennis Rodkin. He writes about real estate in Cranes, and we're going to take a break. Dennis will come back for his all celebrity section of the Business Lunch. It's 12:22. Steve Bertrand here in the Wintrust Business Lunch. Dennis Rodkin's in the studio as well. He writes about real estate for Crane Chicago Business. You can see his stories at chicagobusiness.com and sometimes at TMZ because he likes to follow the celebrities too.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, let's talk about celebrities and real estate. First, I saw the story that you wrote, was it maybe earlier this week, about Jonathan Taves, who bought a big, fancy Lincoln Park mansion, basically, right?
Yeah.
Puts it back on the market in a year.
In under 2 years. He bought it in fall of 2014, and he has just listed it this week. And while, you know, I couldn't reach him, all his agent would say is he's downsizing. It's too much space. It seems
that just cracks me up. He's downsizing.
Yeah.
I mean, that sounds like the kids are out of the house. He's the kid.
He's the kid. Yeah, it's odd. It seems odd to me to buy and put it back on the market so quickly. But, you know, I mean, he's known for lightning fast reflexes, right?
Well, you're right. I picture a guy who's like, well, this would be nice. And then you get in this big house.
And think, yeah, and I'm using one room of it, right? I never go on that floor where there are a couple of bedrooms. Yeah, probably. And you just start to, he may miss the downtown life. He may, I mean, they won't say where he's moving. We may find out at some point. But, you know, he may have found some really sweet downtown penthouse. Just
right.
A guess.
Or maybe he just found a build a house kit and he's going to build a house and live in the Park District somewhere and truly downsize.
That seems very likely from a star of the black.
But I love the Taves. So he bought it less than 2 years ago. And if all goes well for him, he could make about $500,000 on it.
Yeah, he's asking 10% more than he paid about 2 years ago. And he may have made a lot of improvements. I mean, the market in Lincoln Park has improved. I don't think it's up 10% since he bought. But they wouldn't tell me, you know, did he renovate the kitchen? Did he put something into it that might justify asking so much more? But they're not authorized to speak.
When the rest of us sell our homes, you know, we bake cookies to give that nice smell.
Yeah.
He should just hang hawk sweaters in every room. So, right?
That's, he probably does.
That's got to goose the value a little bit.
Yeah, well, you can, I guess the question would be whether he'd leave those hawk sweaters when, it, you know, do you get to have them with the house?
For 500 grand. Okay, let's come downtown because we've talked a lot about the big condos, the full floor condos, and how much they're going for. And another guy, Vince Vaughn, bought a big chunk of the Palmolive building.
Yeah.
Right? Was it two stories?
It was three stories.
Three
it was 12,000 square feet. It includes Hugh Hefner's old office when the Palmolive building was the Playboy building, a couple of terraces. It's enormous. It's 12,000 square feet, which is a huge suburban house, but it's on three floors of the Palmolive
building.
That's
a few huge suburban houses.
Well, yeah,
really.
That's true.
Okay, and so he's been trying to sell it for a couple of years.
Yeah, 5 years.
Didn't go so well.
So a little over a week ago, he split it in two. I had a story, others did as well, saying he split it into a two-story piece and a one-story piece, and they were priced separately. Still over $12 million. He paid $12 for it, and the combined price of those two pieces was $12.7. And in a week, they went under contract. The idea being there are two people who would buy those smaller pieces, but there's not one person who would buy the great big piece.
Well, I like in the story you point out that, you know, there's a very limited number of buyers for three stories. Right. As if the pie for two stories is much bigger.
Well, yeah, the two-story piece is like 8,000 square feet, and there are a lot of 8,000-square-foot houses and condos in the city that sell. I think there's going to be more to this story. They both went under contract same day in less than a week. There's more to the story, and we'll see how it plays out.
What do you mean there's more to the story?
I don't know yet, but it seems awfully convenient that you break it up, and then right away both pieces sell.
So Okay, so when I hear that, I hear you saying that maybe he had the two buyers lined up before he agreed to do it.
Possibly.
Or maybe someone approached him.
It might be that the agent said, that somebody approached him and said, I really only want two pieces. And the agent went out and said, look, I've got this other piece. I don't know any of this. This is total speculation. I hope to find out as the public records play out and things like that. But
it's what you're here for, Dennis. You're here to speculate.
I'm here to speculate. It's my job.
This is radio. It's not print. It doesn't last as long.
Oh, good. Yeah. Oh, good. Well, that's good. Nobody should ever look.
Wait a minute. We podcast everything now, so it does.
Oh, that's true. I'm on the record. But what he did has worked for other people. This is the kind of interesting thing. Vaughn did it. Bill Wrigley did it several years ago when he also had 12,000 square feet at 65 East Gothy. There was a penthouse on top of a building in Lincoln Park on Lakeview Street, which confuses people, that was about 18,000 square feet, I think. And when they split that apart, those two pieces sold. Breaking up seems to work.
So if you've got maybe 2,000 square foot and you divide it up into 1,000, probably not the same thing.
Probably not the same thing, yeah, because there are people, I mean, because there's a market for it. The problem here is we had for a while a bunch of over 10,000 square foot penthouses available, and we have had a couple of buys of over 10,000 square foot penthouses, but we haven't had that many.
This is Dennis Rodkin. You can read more at chicagobusiness.com. Thanks for coming in today.
Thanks, Steve.
You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Thanks very much, Kim Gordon. You're listening to The Business Lunch here on 720 WGN. My name is Steve Bertrand. Thanks for listening. I hope you'll follow me on Facebook or on Twitter. I am at Steve Bertrand on Twitter. Same thing on Facebook. Or you can send me a text at 312-981-7200. You know, Springfield, they're always looking for money, ways to increase revenue. And there's been a movement toward legalizing recreational marijuana. And one of the reasons to do that would be to raise money. Not too far away from the way we introduced gambling in this state 20 years ago or so. Is that the next thing? How much money would it bring in? We will talk about that with a public economist coming up a little bit later in the program. We're going to stay sort of in marketing now. Elise Klink joins us on a phone line, as she does most Thursdays, in studio or on the phone, to talk about marketing. Elise is the co-host of Monday Morning Marketing. You can hear that at WGMplus.com. Elise, welcome to the program.
Hey, Steve. Nice to be here.
That's the longest introduction I've ever had, and really, I didn't even cover half of what you do.
It's plenty. Everybody knows me.
So, you know, I want to start with, there's an article in the News Gazette out of Champaign this week about, you know, the University of Illinois has had big problems. They've had the Steven Salata case where they hired and then tried to unfire a professor and were sued and had to settle. Phyllis Weiss, who was the chancellor there, has been moved out a number of people. They fired their football coach right before the season. I mean, in many ways, that school is a mess, right? We can stipulate that. Will you agree with me on that?
I think so. I think that the university system in Illinois, and I went to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, so we're talking about my alma mater. I think they're definitely in trouble, and part of the reason, of course, is the state is in trouble financially.
Sure.
So money is an issue right now.
So it makes sense that they would say, look, we need to, if not rebrand ourselves, we need to reinforce our brand or reestablish our brand to make things move. Again, that's a logical step, correct?
Absolutely.
So we're learning today that they hired Edelman, which is a very respected company, signed the contract last year to a contract that would help them deal with Salata and deal with this rebranding just like that. And they agreed to pay them $550,000. I think it was a 3-year deal. The new chancellor, when she came in, Barbara Wilson, quietly put the kibosh on that contract. I think it was last August, but still the state or the school had to pay Edelman $382,000, so by far the bulk of the contract. Now, I'm a completely a layman to all of this. You know the business. You know the rates. Is that a legitimate contract?
I wish I had it.
Yeah, I do too.
That's a nice amount of money. You know, I don't know what the article talks a little bit about some of the things that Edelman was doing. So I don't think it was just hand us some money and, you know, we're just going to bless something. I think they actually probably had a pretty detailed amount of work, and it does sound like they went in and they did a whole lot of interviewing and they've started, you know, did some high level thinking on it. I don't know what it was they were supposed to do. I haven't seen the contract details, but I do think that even if the money was paid privately, the optics are bad. And one of the things that companies don't often think about when they're making these kinds of decisions, and same thing with the university, is how does it look on the outside versus what they're actually getting for the money on the inside? Optics matter.
Well, and so a lot of times the knee-jerk reactions come from people who really don't know what they're talking about. And I will be that person in this scenario, happily. Because when I see it, I'm thinking, wait a minute, don't you have a whole school developed to marketing or that is determined to teach kids how to market products? Couldn't you go within the institution to come up with your own plan? Now, that probably presents a conflict because you don't really want the employees creating a brand for the institution. I'm not sure of that. But
well, that's what they've just done, though. So the solution was, wow, we have all this internal talent. Why don't we turn to our people for free, basically, because we're already paying them their salaries to come and help us, you know, with this plan and to create something of value. I actually think that there is a movement in universities across the country to turn to the kids that they are teaching, and I say kids, but I mean anybody up into their mid to late 20s who are actually, you know, some of them are getting master's or PhDs, turn to them, you've already got this talent, and give them a challenge to go and design for other things. And you're seeing this, whether it's in engineering or you're seeing it in business startups. If these 20-somethings are smart enough to develop Uber, right, they're probably smart enough to fix a branding problem caused by either mismanagement or corruption or whatever is the case. And while branding is awfully nice, and it's a nice to have, it definitely can come back and bite you, like this one is starting to bite the University of Illinois.
Well, in my world, I tend to think of universities as compact sort of universes, there's the word, in and of themselves. I mean, they teach, they do everything, they should be able to handle those things within their own community. And I guess that's what you're saying. We're starting to see them sort of return to that model.
It is. I mean, the university, it sounds like from the story, that, and we're just going on that, right? The university hired Edelman back in April of 2015, so about a year, little over a year ago, not much more than that, to set the stage for a major fundraising drive that's supposed to kick off next year. And they were also brought in to help with crisis communications. And oftentimes you will see companies hire a company like Edelman or another company that specializes in crisis communications. Fleischmann Hillard is another one that does quite a lot of that. And then there are a lot of smaller companies. Because you do need the outside set of eyes. You need somebody who's not beholden to the money that's internal, right, in your job to actually be the no person in a sea of yes men women.
And even if it's not the money, it's just the, you know, looking at the elephant in the room or the thing that the people on the inside might not necessarily see.
Yeah, I mean, the emperor's not wearing any clothes, and somebody's got to be willing to say, you know, listen, you're not wearing any clothes. You might want to do something about that. But when you're working with a big university, a lot of times it's really hard to find people who haven't drunk the Kool-Aid. And the people who haven't, who are oftentimes at odds, you don't want to listen to them because what do they know? And so you can get yourself, whether you're a company or a university, into a situation where it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. So I don't actually think the decision to hire an Edelman is a bad one at all. I think that when you're as broke as the university is, and you're talking about laying off 1,500 people, as they did earlier this year, this is bad optics. And I give kudos to the person who came in and said, you know, we probably should end this.
Yeah,
looking for a different solution.
Looks like that was the new chancellor, Barbara Wilson, did that. And to her credit, maybe it was to her credit, she did it without big fanfare. She didn't say, hey, look at what I'm cutting here. She just did it and said it's time to move on. Now, maybe that's because optics matter, and she was happier when this contract wasn't sort of widely known. Look, it's a great institution. It's a great school. It's produced people like Elise Glink, and we all want it to succeed and do well. What would you do to, if you were in charge of rebranding them in the 30 seconds we have left, how would you fix it?
You know, I think you have to look at what the university is known for. And, you know, while a university, and I'll just take this out and we'll talk about Baylor for a moment. You know, Baylor's in the news today because it has demoted its chancellor from being president, Ken Starr, the former prosecutor, and they fired their football coach, although he's been a winning coach for them. They rebranded that university on the backs of a successful football team. I think in the state of Illinois, where you have the University of Illinois with the number four engineering program in the country, and you could argue the world, what you want to do is brand behind smarts and the intellectual capabilities that the university has, rather than looking for sort of outside stuff, pull people in with smarts. And I would rebrand around that.
There is some irony in Ken Starr being brought down by a sex scandal, isn't there?
There, you know, it's just lovely sometimes to see how the world turns.
That's the least link. Listen to her at WGNplus.com. The podcast is the Monday Morning Marketing. I got it right there. Elise, thanks for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Absolutely.
We'll talk again next week. You're listening to The Business Lunch on 720 WGN. All right, Illinois needs money. The U of I needs money. How about if we turn to pot? We'll kick that around after this on 720. Well, the traders are off on Memorial Day, but Michael Heidemann, the producer of The Business Lunch, and Steve Bertrand, your erstwhile host, will be working. We'll be here on Monday, and hope you will be as well. All right, so maybe a lot of you over the weekend will be partaking of illegal drugs. We don't know that, and I don't want to predict that, but, you know, there's a movement toward maybe making marijuana legal, recreational marijuana, not medical, legal in Illinois. I think there is a bill that the governor might sign that would decriminalize it, so that would reduce some of the penalties. What if they made it legal? How much money could Illinois make when it comes to taxes? Natalie Davila is a public finance economist, and she wrote a piece that she did a study, and I saw an account of it at rebootillinois.com about that, about what sort of tax revenue the state could generate with legalized pot. She joins us on a phone line now. Natalie, welcome to The Business Lunch.
Thanks very much for having me.
All right, so I know we have to start sort of with the caveat that this is what economists do. They take numbers, they extrapolate, but it's really not hard and fast. You're looking at models from other states and trying to predict what might happen here in Illinois, correct?
Yeah, that's correct. This is one of the most difficult challenges I've had in my career, to estimate the revenue from marijuana, because it's such a new concept and there's very little hard data already available.
It's legal in four states, recreational marijuana now, correct?
That's correct, yeah, with a wide variety of tax rates and legal infrastructure.
So we've got Alaska, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington State. You looked at all of those and tried to figure out, by those different models, how Illinois might do. So what'd you come up with?
Well, again, the revenue estimates vary significantly, both in terms of the estimate of the Illinois market size and also the tax structure in these states. But, for example, if we adopted a model like Colorado, which has a 15% excise tax, the estimate could be upward of $300 million once implementation was fully rolled out. On the other hand, looking at Oregon, it's a fairly recent phenomenon in Oregon. The estimate on that side would be closer to $130 million.
So we're looking at
a big range.
Yeah, we're looking at two things, right? There's the excise tax, which is sort of traditionally the wholesale tax, and then there's the sales tax. Some states do both. Some states don't do both.
That's correct.
And
for example, in Washington or in Oregon, they don't have a sales tax.
Well, I mean, I just think we should tax the hemp out of it, don't you? If we're going to make it legal, people want to buy it. We need the money. Let's jack up the price a little bit. Who's got the highest taxes?
Right now, Washington State is on the high end. Its tax rate is 37%.
Okay, and so when you do these reports, I know you're coming up with models of what might be. Do you suggest a recommendation for a model of taxing to follow, or are you just sort of saying this is what's out here, this is what we might be able to bring in?
The latter. At this point, we were doing this study because there's a lot of numbers being thrown around. Illinois's got a huge deficit, structural
sure.
deficit. Today, you know, the outstanding bills are close to $7 billion on paid bills this year. So in terms of, we're just looking in terms of degree of magnitude so that this concept is not oversold.
Well, you know, that's a good point. So, I mean, I think, I'm not sure, I don't want to commit, I think I might be all for it, but even if it is, you're saying best case scenario, $536 million a year, which, you know, is not a drop in the bucket, but it's not going to solve the problems either.
Well, actually, the numbers for the bill that is being proposed in Illinois, the tax rate is very low. It's 10%. So the range on the estimates of that bill are from $50 million to $115 million.
Oh, so that's even lower. You're right. Okay.
To put that in perspective, you know, the liquor tax brings in $170 million. Cigarette tax brings in $800 million. So this particular proposal doesn't touch the revenue generated from that, doesn't come close to either of those other sin taxes.
Well, that's good to know when we consider whether or not we think it's a good idea. Natalie Davila, a public economist, public finance economist, thanks very much for joining us today. I appreciate it.
Welcome the opportunity to share the research.
Hope we can talk
thanks
again.
Very much.
You're listening to the business. Oops, bye-bye, Natalie. You're listening to the Business Lunch on 720 WGN.